ladies and gentlemen. Our next event of the evening is a one-fall match.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio.
With a 60-minute time limit.
What I'd like to have right now...
where the big boys play.
This is where the big boys play, huh?
This is where the big boys play.
WrestleSpective Radio.
Where the big boys play.
WrestleSpective Radio.
Where the big boys play.
WrestleSpective Radio.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Where the Big Boys Play and Jason to WrestleSpective Radio. I'm here with Jason Mann. How are you, Jason?
Great. Thank you for having me on the show, or thanks for us doing this joint show together, I guess. But anyway, I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, Chad was also scheduled to be with us, but he was called away last minute by work. Which was a shame, because I believe he really enjoyed Clash of the Champions. Jason, I've listened to your show for quite a while now. How long has that podcast been going?
About a couple years. It took a little while for us to do, like, we did like probably five or six episodes over a number of months, and we started making it a regular thing, I guess, about 2 years ago now. So we've done, 170 shows now, and basically, for those who don't know, it focuses mostly on main events of pay-per-views, whether WWE, WCW, ECW, TNA, we've done the Herb Abrams UWF. So basically any major or not so major company that did a national pay-per-view, we're willing to cover it. And I have different rotation of guests every time, and we just kind of talk about the match and the context of what was going on and the past storylines and future storylines and any just interesting things about it. So that is what it is.
Yeah, and I've always been impressed by just how prolific you are. I remember one time, every single time I'd put iTunes on, you'd have another show up where you basically burned through the SummerSlam pay-per-views. Where in fact, you've done quite a lot of main events where you just run through year by year looking at WrestleMania, SummerSlam, Starrcade. You've basically done them all, right?
Yeah, I've done all of those three. So I haven't done that in a while, because that is quite a bit of work, and I don't quite have as much time as I used to have, or I'm maybe not willing to devote quite as much time as I used to, but we do a show or two every week, kind of depends. It's been kind of slow going for the last couple of months, because I've been in the midst of some stuff, but I'm sure we'll get going again pretty soon.
Yeah, well, I mean, as far as we're concerned on this show, momentum is really difficult to keep up, you know. We all have busy lives and things, and it's just finding the time to do this once a week often proves problematic, which is why there's often like a two-week gap. And then sometimes we may have a couple of shows in a week. You know, it really just depends on the way the cookie crumbles.
Indeed.
Just before we go into Clash of the Champions, I think it might be worth asking you how long you've been a wrestling fan. What got you into wrestling? Just give us a bit of your story, your journey, I guess, to what brought you to being on the other side of the microphone.
Sure. I first became a fan around 1986. I was 7 years old, and the first thing I really remember was Hulk Hogan being attacked by a King Kong Bundy and being avalanched repeatedly in the corner, and I believe Don Morocco holding him as King Kong Bundy was doing this. So this would have been the lead up to WrestleMania 2. And I think the thing that stuck with me was later that year, the famous Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat angle, where Savage drops the ring bell on Steamboat's throat. I remember Steamboat clutching it, and it just being the fear that he, was seriously hurt and just you know, and being captivated by the stories and by, you know, the action and so forth, obviously, like most wrestling fans are hooked into. So it was around that time I was a serious fan for the next 3 or 4 years, give or take. But I was really exclusively a WWF fan as far as watching goes. I followed NWA through magazine stuff, but I was always kind of puzzled by them because it just seemed like the good guys almost never won, or if they won, their victories were fleeting. And that as a kid was just something that, you know, was confusing and not really appealing to me, that I didn't really want to watch it. But looking back on it, I wish I had given it more of a chance, because I think I would have enjoyed it just based on the characters and based on the in-ring stuff, and especially a show like this. You know, I was a devout WWF fan, as I mentioned, so I was watching WrestleMania 4 at the time, in which this went head-to-head. So, you know, I have watched WrestleMania 4 probably more times than I've watched any other wrestling show, because it was one of the few that I actually had on tape myself and would watch it over and over again. So even though it's considered historically a terrible show, I have a very strong affinity for it, just because of those memories and based on Randy Savage winning the title being my favorite wrestler. But, you know, looking at it objectively, there's no way that that show compares to how great this show is.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, are you some sort of masochist? Because it is like 4 hours long. I always remember the VHS for WrestleMania 4 was like the double... It was like the double spine, and it had a big picture of Andre on it. It used to create problems for my shelving. I'm quite fond of WrestleMania 4 as well, to be honest. I mean, it's kind of... all the matches are pretty short, you know? It kind of moves along fairly nicely.
Although, the only thing that's really bad on it is Rick Rude and Jake Roberts, like, which is a 15-minute draw, which just seems to go on forever. But but everything else is fun and short, and the Randy Savage story is fun, and the comedy with Bob Uecker I enjoy. So but that's not what we're talking about, obviously.
No, although WrestleMania 4 is important, as we'll get on to later. But let's just so you were a fan around this time, and you, a lot of people have a kind of gap where they kind of stop watching wrestling. It sounds to me that you had one of these as well at some point. When did that occur?
Yeah, that was more. I think I had like a real, like a 2 to 3 year period where I was watching like almost every week or whatever, and was following it very closely, and then kind of gradually lost interest for a couple more years. And then I remember I think I got back into it seriously just for like a spell, like late 91, early 92. Right. And once I realized they weren't going to do Hogan Flair, as definitely, you know, was teased heavily, that that I lost interest in it almost completely and didn't get back into it until 96, and then really heavily in 97.
Yeah, I've said it before. I think a lot of fans have a gap around the time the Luger Lex Express thing happens. I think a lot of fans weren't watching in 94, 95.
Yeah, it was the kind of thing where I would check in like every 6 months or so, definitely around WrestleMania time, just to kind of see what was going on. But yeah, other than that, yeah, I was not paying very close to attention to it at all.
Considering what the sort of reputation of Bret Hart, and considering he was champ at that time, I always thought it was interesting that he was really champion at a very kind of dark period for the WWF. I actually think WCW 93, 94, at least up until Hogan comes in, is actually pretty good. It's really slept on. You did the Beach Blast 92 show recently, and I actually really like, we haven't got up to it on this show yet, but I really liked the promotion during that time period. I thought they were building something quite interesting there, like a real alternative to what WWF were doing. So you got back on board during the Attitude Era, right?
Definitely. I think the NWO was the thing that hooked me at first, and then getting into the Bret Hart, the Hart Foundation, Steve Austin storyline, and then Austin versus McMahon. I mean, I'm a lot of people kind of followed the trajectory that I did, were, you know, getting into it into the late 80s and kind of fading, and then, you know, sort of the nostalgia combined with some exciting new ideas kind of brought everyone back and then created sort of another boom that obviously went bust. And I, you know, sort of, I've stuck with it ever since, but there have been definitely periods where I've watched it almost every week, and there have been periods where, you know, I'll watch it once in a while, still follow along on the internet. Obviously the internet makes that easier, and even obviously today I can pretty much just watch whatever I want to watch afterward. Usually I don't even bother watching Raw, or it's kind of something I do every month or so, and then just kind of follow the on Twitter or on, you know, Observer or different websites, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've actually stopped watching since I think it's about 2004 now, so I literally don't watch the modern product at all. And I mean, well, once in a while, like once every few months, I might put it on. I got half an hour into WrestleMania this year before I turned it off in semi-disgust. So I didn't even.
Was there anything that in 2004 that just was like, okay, this is enough, or was it just accumulation of whatever?
Well, I mean, for a start, as you get older, it becomes kind of more difficult to keep track of it week after week. But I think it was I watched all the legacy stuff. Is it what they call legacy?
You mean Evolution?
Flair, Triple H faction.
Yeah.
And then
Evolution.
Evolution, yeah. That's what it was called. And then I seem to remember Cena came in, and the product had really become something I just was no longer interested in. Like, for me, wrestling's all about larger than life characters and interesting angles, and it seemed to me that it was becoming more and more about this kind of new metal, like a whole culture that I'm not really part of and never will be. Like, I couldn't really relate to any of the characters. I hated Randy Orton and his kind of snake thing that he was doing around that time. I don't know if he still does that, but it was really difficult for me to get behind a lot of the new guys that were coming out. And I mean, even now, they all look the same to me. Like, you don't get like, it's almost unimaginable for a guy like Dick Murdoch, for example, to be around now. Like, you just don't get the equivalent of that. So
yeah.
It's very homogenized, you know. I mean, I don't want to be down on the current product too much, but I think we've also had in the past few years an explosion of footage from the past. So I mean, I've literally got so many DVDs here of stuff that I still haven't watched that I could probably, this is a big claim, but I could probably go the rest of my life only watching stuff from the 80s and 90s and still not exhaust all the stuff I've got here.
I know what you mean. I certainly have that feeling with stuff online, and you know, there's so much interesting wrestling out there that the things that are going on now don't seem nearly as compelling. Once in a while, there'll be something, but for the most part, it's like, yeah, why do I have any interest in this when there's just this history and this, you know, all these different, you know, cultures of wrestling and all these different places that, you know, that I haven't explored that seem much more fascinating than anything today.
Yeah, well, no, but exactly that. And I mean, I wouldn't rule out ever kind of getting back on board, but I think the WWE need an entire change of policy and direction. Like, it's far too, it's almost like nothing is organic, everything's kind of really manufactured to within an inch of its life, and so therefore everything comes across as inauthentic. And I think that's the basic problem. No amount of good, even if the matches are good, the basic presentation is something that I find a real barrier. Okay, so Clash of the Champions, the very first Clash of the Champions, let's get on to that. It happened in March of 1988. I think it was March 27th?
That's correct.
This was the very same night as the aforementioned WrestleMania 4. And this is was part, really part of a new tactic from Jim Crockett Promotions, who I mean, Vince had really put their nose out of joint with what they did with the Starrcade show when they put Survivor Series head to head with it. And Vince basically has strong-armed a lot of the pay-per-view carriers, and he said, "Well, if you take Starrcade, we are not going to carry, we're not going to give you WrestleMania 4," and of course WrestleMania 3 had been huge. So Crockett found themselves in a situation where there were a lot of pay-per-view carriers who weren't carrying, you know, their flagship show Starrcade. So I guess one of the ways that they fought back was by putting this show, Clash of the Champions, free to air on Superstation TBS, head to head with WrestleMania. So you could either pay whatever it was, $20 to watch WrestleMania, or for free, you could watch Sting versus Flair on this show. So it was pretty good move. And reading the Meltzer from this period, he seems to think that about 2 million people watch this show, as opposed to about 500,000 who watched WrestleMania. But although obviously each of those 500,000 had given money for it, whereas this was free to air. So I'm guessing WWF still made more money that night. And this was in Greensboro, right in their backyard, in the Greensboro Coliseum. Mm-hmm. And he also told us that it only drew 6,000 fans. So... and that can actually be accounted for since it was being shown live on TV. You know, only your hardcore NWA fans are going to turn up when they can watch it for free, which I find an interesting justification. Maybe the mindset of fans was different then than it is now. I mean, any thoughts on that, Jason?
What you just mean as far as not necessarily showing up if you can see it for free?
Yeah, I mean, I like it. If I mean, if I was in Greensboro, I'd probably be tempted to go.
Yeah, I would think so. You know, I know that NWA had cooled off a lot, or you know, Crockett, better way to put it, yeah. Crockett had cooled off a lot, and they had also made Greensboro unhappy by moving Starrcade out of that market. So in Starrcade 87, which was in Chicago, so that may have been kind of a blowback from that. As far as you know, I've read Meltzer's history of Starrcade, and he mentioned that as kind of being a key to not killing, but certainly hurting their business there. So maybe that had something to do with it. And also, I don't know. Like, obviously, Sting and Flair is a legendary match now, but I'm not sure how Sting was viewed at the time, whether that would have been something that necessarily would have drawn huge at the time. In retrospect, this made Sting a star, but Sting wasn't quite a star at the time. He was more of, you know, kind of like an up and kind of, it would be like, I don't know, John Cena wrestling. I'm trying to think of a good parallel, but you know, kind of a, like an Intercontinental title level guy suddenly getting a chance against John Cena. Is that something that that would, you know, flock people to go see? Yeah, not necessarily.
Yeah, and I mean, you can actually see that. I mean, at Starrcade, and also at the Bunkhouse Stampede. I mean, Sting was over, but you can see he was way down the card there, and that was only
right.
Like three, four months before this. So that's a very short space of time for him to go from being, you know, just a tag guy on the opening match to being in the main event. So this is kind of a massively accelerated push. One of the things we should remember is that there were a lot of firings and people walking out of Crockett at this time. I mentioned last time the Rock and Roll Express bailed on the promotion. Meltzer actually has a few more notes about why that was. They were asked a job to Ivan Koloff and the Warlord, and they weren't happy about that. So that was one of the reasons that they left. And also Michael Hayes was fired because of some unspecified incident Do you happen to know off the top of your head what that incident was?
Meltzer. No, I don't. I've never heard about that, actually.
But, yeah, well, Michael Hayes was fired. He was obviously tagging with Jimmy Garvin at this time. Ron Garvin actually stepped in as the new partner of Jimmy Garvin. Meltzer actually speculates that some of these firings weren't because of the reasons that people were saying, that they were actually because of financial difficulties. And Hayes had actually signed this big money contract a couple of years previous. He kind of signed it in advance. But apparently Jim Crockett Jr. had never actually signed this contract. So when Hayes kind of put pressure on them to sign this permanent contract, they found, you know, some reason to get rid of him. So, and you know what Hayes was like at that time. He was kind of, you know, it probably wouldn't have been difficult to find him, you know, drunk and disorderly or something.
probably not. So, given his reputation, certainly.
But I seem to remember reading that the main event for this show would have been Hayes versus Flair, had Hayes not been fired. So Sting is only really getting this spot because a spot has opened up on the card. Because you got to remember that Flair was still kind of feuding with the Garvins, like Ronnie Garvin and Jimmy Garvin. You know, Starcade wasn't that long ago, and I don't think that feud had entirely been settled. And he'd already wrestled, you know, both of the Garvins. So the next in line was Michael Hayes, because he was, you know, they were kind of part of a faction together at that time.
Sure.
The only other news I have from the Meltzer is that he says that Ted Turner is now in bed with JCP to help them with their pay-per-view push. And I've just written here, watch this space on that. and the other thing is that Paul Bosch, the Houston promoter who retired last year, is actually back as part of the NWA board of directors. More on them later in this show. So let's get on to it then. Your hosts for tonight are, well, initially Tony Schiavone and Bob Caudle, but then the announced team is actually Tony Schiavone and Jim Ross, with Caudle as kind of a on-air interviewer slash host. We go into the first match. And before I get into this, I will say that clearly the version of this that I had was recorded on TV, probably in, you know, 1988 on Betamax or something, because the audio quality was absolutely atrocious. I don't know what you found, Jason.
Yeah, mine was basically the same. We probably saw the same version, so.
Yeah, and I did actually have a look around for some different versions, but it seems like that is the one. That is the one that we have. So a lot of the commentary and even some of the interview segments, it was very difficult to make out what they're saying. Did you ever play those old WWF arcade games? There was WrestleFest.
A little bit, not that much, but
there was WrestleFest, and there was.
I did play WrestleFest. Yeah, I played that a lot. Actually, I completely forgot about that, but I was. Yeah, I was always Sergeant Slaughter and Hulk Hogan for some reason. I don't know why, but
there was also one with DiBiase and Andre as the end bosses, like the previous game to WrestleFest, and that they had this kind of interview at the start, you know, where you could hear like a voiceover, and the voice was all kind of garbled, you know, in kind of like that late 80s, early 90s digitized voice. And a lot of the interviews on this show sounded a bit like that to me, reminiscent of the promo that Andre and DiBiase give us on that game. Anyway, we start out with a TV title match, and the TV champion at this point is not Nikita Koloff, as it was in the last show, but it's Mike Rotunda. So sometime between the Bunkhouse Stampede and now, Mike Rotunda beat Nikita Koloff for the TV title, and he's facing off against Jimmy Garvin, who's with Precious, and Teddy Long is the ref. So if it's all right with you, Jason, I'll just quickly go through the match, and then I'll ask you for your analysis, you know, for your thoughts.
Sure.
Okay. So they start off by saying that this rule has some interesting rules, that there are three periods. Did you catch what this was about? Was this under some amateur rules or something?
Yeah, the idea was that it was basically amateur rules. I guess the 3 5-minute periods, that would, I guess that would be an amateur wrestling thing as well. I don't know a whole lot about amateur wrestling. But yeah, the difference between this match and any other match is that if your shoulders are down for a one count, that's the fall instead of it being a three count.
Right. Okay. Well, I seem to miss that. But then that's because I couldn't really hear what the commentary team was saying. So a one count is a pin here.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. Oh, right. I totally didn't know this. Mike Rotunda is actually with the Varsity Club. The Varsity Club are formed by this stage. So he's with Kevin Sullivan here in his corner. And, of course, Rick Stein is the other member of that. And he comes out to some interesting varsity music and a college jacket. Just before we get into this match, one of the weird things about Mike Rotunda is that run he has is the US Express. I always think that's a really weird tag title run for some reason. When was it, 85?
I guess it would have been 85 into maybe early 86. Is it just odd because it's just different from his other characters, or something about him is trying to be the all-American guy that you just don't buy?
I don't know, it seems unusually early for Mike Rotunda to be getting a tag title run in the WF. And because like he goes from there to Florida, it's just like, where does that tag run come from? You know, it just seems a little out of the.
Well, Rotunda and Wyndham had very similar starts in their careers, so they were working Florida in the early '80s. I've seen, I saw a Mike Rotunda, a Destroyer match from, I think, pretty sure it was from Florida, from like '79 or '80. And I guess the Destroyer trained Rotunda, which I didn't know until recently. He'd actually been around for a while, but you're right. You know, both him and Wyndham, obviously they were guys that were just kind of plucked out of Florida because, you know, Vince in 84 and 85 and even thereafter was just kind of plucking, you know, whoever he could get, whoever they felt had talent in there. So, I mean, my assumption is that Rotunda and Wyndham were kind of their counter to sort of like the pretty boy baby faces that were, you know, the Rock and Roll Express and the like. They were obviously a bit different from that, but they were kind of, you know, an attempt to be a heartthrob team and also, I guess, have that patriotism wave as well, kind of a combination.
Yeah. It's kind of an oddly forgotten little team, that, as well, the U.S. Express.
I think it was just because that really people think of the start of WWF tag wrestling as being, at least maybe for me, maybe this isn't everyone, but of being the British Bulldogs and Hart Foundation feud. That's kind of what is thought of as kind of the big, you know, the launching pad for their, you know, 3 or 4 years of really good tag team wrestling.
Yeah, well, I guess you could push it back to the Dream Team.
Them too. But right. I mean, I the Dream Team and Bulldogs had a great rivalry, but I just think of like when I feel like the consensus of when the of like kind of what stands out as far as those that division, kind of the genesis is of Hart Foundation and British Bulldogs. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's just kind of where I've, you know, or at least in my mind, even though, yeah, I like the British Bulldogs and Dream Team feud a lot too, but, you know, I guess just because of the family connection and the angles later and all that, that's where it begins in my head.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I do think that retrospectively, well, for a certain type of fan, retrospectively, a lot of people kind of elevate things that somebody like a Brett was involved with, you know.
Right.
What I mean by that, it's kind of if somebody who's pimped later was involved with something, it kind of retroactively achieves a significance that, you know, in the minds of fans. Does that make any sense?
I think so. Yeah.
Anyway, let's get back to Jimmy Garvin versus Mike Rotunda. We start off with a leg takedown from Rotunda, and then an arm drag takeover, and I can barely hear Ross and Schiavone, but they're saying that this is going to be a very amateur style match, and these couple of moves kind of get that over pretty quickly. We get some cocky star jumps from Rotunda. Ross and Schiavone take some time to hype the upcoming Crockett Cup. There's some offense from Garvin now. Rotunda bails. We get a headlock from Rotunda. Before long, the first period is up. Now, was there a pin here? But maybe I missed the fact that there was a pin, but I just thought
no.
The time period expires, right?
Yeah, the time period is pretty. He at the end of it, Rotunda is trying to roll the shoulders down of Garvin. They're kind of close to the ropes, and he's getting close, and then the bell sounds for the end of the first 5 minute round.
Garvin body slams Rotunda from the top. We get a backdrop. He goes for a suplex, but then Sullivan, Kevin Sullivan, is up on the apron. He has Precious. But then from there, Rotunda steals the pin. Now, was this a three count or a one count?
It was a one count.
This was a one count, and that's enough for the win here.
Yes.
Okay. They just need one count to win the entire match. Okay.
That's apparently what you need in amateur wrestling. So that was the idea. I kind of think that's weird, but I did liked the psychology of having to avoid it and of having to get up very, very quickly out of the near falls. It just made like a different pace of the match and different, a different type of match. And I thought it was actually pretty cool.
Just to finish up here, Rick Steiner comes out. Precious nails him, I think. With a 2x4. I don't know where she got this 2x4 from, but she had one. She hits him with a 2x4. I was expecting to see Hacksaw.
He was there.
Then she chokes Sullivan pretty nastily with a wire, and I was like, wow, Precious is going for it here.
Yeah.
Apparently it was a coat hanger, this bit of wire that she had.
Oh, okay.
What did you think? You've already touched on it. What did you think of this one?
Yeah, like I said, I thought it was interesting. It was fast-paced. I thought Garvin looked pretty good. I've always liked Jimmy Garvin, even though he kind of gets... I've heard people kind of, diss him, especially his later work with the Freebirds. And even some of that I've looked back on and enjoyed. So I don't know. Maybe just the type of thing where if you see it too much, you get sick of it. But the little bits and pieces I've got, I think were good. But yeah, I thought obviously this type of thing gets over the Varsity Club gimmick. Rotunda being from Syracuse and being the amateur wrestler, which is kind of a weird gimmick, especially with Kevin Sullivan being the guy behind him dressed in the Prince of Darkness robe, managing these amateur guys. But I thought it worked for what it was trying to do. It wasn't anything fantastic, but I thought Rotunda did some nice heel work. You mentioned I've never heard them called star jumps, but I call them, or I they're known, at least maybe that's a British thing, but but for us it's jumping jacks, that Rotunda did.
Right,
but I thought that was a nice, just the little things that he did as a heel. I actually think this gimmick fits him better than any of his other characters. I never really particularly cared for him as IRS, and I always thought as a babyface he just, he was a more natural, arrogant heel. So I, like I said, I thought it was good execution and a good story, and the stuff at the end was good. Precious, the heels are selling a lot for her, but she was pretty vicious with that 2x4 and that, choking Sullivan, and it got over that story pretty well. That's going to, continue on through a decent amount of 88.
Yeah, well, I have to say, personally, I wasn't particularly fond of this match. I don't know why. I just didn't think it had much going on.
Okay.
But it may be that I missed it because I didn't know about this one count. It may be that I missed a major kind of chunk of the psychology here. But I, for whatever reason, I just thought this was a little bit kind of, you know, it was all right, but it was a little bit bland for what it was, which I guess could maybe a criticism of Rotunda in general, that he's a little bit bland.
Yeah, he's not Mr. Excitement, that's for sure. But I thought, you know, everything was well executed, and you know, it kind of made sense. And like I said, I thought that the pace was good, so it wasn't anything, you know, mind blowing by any stretch. But it's, you know, it did its job.
Yeah, and it didn't outstay its welcome. It was definitely over, because when they said, "Oh, there's going to be three rounds," I was thinking, "Oh God, this is going to go on forever." But
right. But basically, the beginning of the second round is where it ends. So.
Yeah. To be honest, actually, I was I think I was more confused about the rules than anything. So when it ended, it seemed a little bit abrupt, and I was like, "Oh, right, is that it?" I did enjoy the post match. I thought it was good to see a little bit of viciousness from a face valet.
Yeah.
So we go from here to Bob Caudle, who's with Dr. Death Steve Williams, back from Japan. He didn't. I actually said last time that he was flown over for the Bunkhouse Stampede, but clearly Meltzer got that wrong, because in the very next edition of Wrestling Observer, he says that for whatever reason, Williams stayed in Japan a couple of weeks later, and he only came back at this point. We get a promo here from Dr. Death where he says he's going to face the winner of Flair versus Sting. He's got a shot at the world title. I noticed during this interview that, for whatever reason, right, just in this interview, he looked quite a lot like Scott Steiner with a beard to me. I don't know why, like, facially, he seems to have a very similar face to Scott Steiner. Yeah, I thought this was a pretty average promo, to be honest, from Steve Williams. And any thoughts, Jason?
Yeah, he stumbled over a few words here and there. I mean, it got across the point. It's interesting that he does, as far as I know, does not challenge Flair anywhere afterward, and is basically in the mid card for you know, the rest of the year. I don't know if he was going back and forth from Japan at this point. I'm guessing he probably was, but it's kind of weird to put a guy in that position and then to pretty much do nothing with him. And then turn him heel pretty quickly afterward, too.
Yeah, I never really got the impression that Dusty or indeed Crockett Promotion in general saw Steve Williams as the main event guy. Like, there's never much enthusiasm behind any of his pushes from when they buy the UWF onwards.
Right.
Until we get to 92, which is quite a way off here. And obviously then Bill Watts has got a severe hard-on for Dr. Death, so he pushes
him. And plus, connection with him as well, obviously. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I will say, I mean, Jim Ross absolutely loves Steve Williams. I mean, I think he's probably one of two or three men that Jim Ross would probably have sex with if he asked nicely. then we go from here to, I don't know if this was on your... copy of it, but there's a commercial for the Four Horsemen performance pills. Do you see this?
Top performance system.
The top performance system. Were these basically steroids?
I don't think so. I think they were, you know, like supplements type thing. But I'm pretty sure that they were not steroids.
Did you ever see these sold in the shops or anything? Did you ever?
No. I wasn't, you know, being not an NWA guy is, you know, I didn't know, you know, their marketing was definitely behind WWF's. You know, if it wasn't a wrestling buddy or an ice cream bar, I probably wasn't really privy to it. But, that was not something that I ever recall seeing in the stores.
I should have asked Jason, where in the parts in the United States are you from? Because
I'm from Ohio, in the Midwest. So
Ohio in the mid, and I mean, is that typically a WWF country? I mean, what?
Yeah. I definitely more WWF. I lived in Toledo at the time, which is like an hour and a half from Detroit, where of course WrestleMania 3 was, and in that area was definitely, you know, a WWF hotbed, because kind of you know, before there was WWF, you know, the territory that was kind of there was the Sheik. But, you know, that territory burned out earlier than most of the ones that burned out because of the competition with Vince. Yeah. So there was a kind of a gap where there was not much local wrestling. And in fact, Georgia Championship Wrestling, you know, in some ways the precursor to WCW, you know, they even ran some in Ohio, you know, in Michigan because of that gap. But my point is, by the time WWF went national, there was a big starving, you know, a starvation of local wrestling, I guess, or of having a wrestling. So I think that area took to WWF more than some of the other ones did.
Yeah, and you can see some parallels with, we had Solomon on a couple of shows ago, who's from LA. Again, the LaBelle promotion, I think, went out kind of quicker than a lot of the other territories. So it was like there was a you know, a void there waiting for Vince to come and fill it, basically.
Exactly.
And I think LA pretty quickly becomes WWF, a WWF town, and indeed California becomes a, you know, WCW obviously ran there, but I think, you know, it was there for the taking for Vince in this time period.
Yeah, Vince even went there a year before before they really went national. Like, they went there in 83 when Backlund was still champion.
Yeah. So by this stage, by 1988, that area of the Midwest is pretty solidly WF.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, where were we? Back to Clash of the Champions, and we have the U.S. tag title match now. Now, I've been critical on the show in the past of the U.S. tag titles. What are your thoughts on having a secondary set of tag titles?
Well, I'm usually more is less kind of guy when it comes to titles, so... or less is more, rather. So I guess the other way works either way. But generally, I would be against them. I do feel like NWA, and maybe not directly in this year, but I think throughout most of the late 80s into like 90, 91, they had enough tag teams and enough tag teams with talent that you could do it, and you could kind of have different things going on with the two different tag titles and kind of make them both meaningful and so forth. So, you know, I still kind of feel like I'm against it, but I'm not like massively against it. I can see why they had them and I can see their use to a certain extent.
Sure. Okay. Well, I know there are a lot of people, and I think it's probably because of the Midnight Express's run, who are big fans of the US tag titles. I'm still not entirely convinced, and I'm not even convinced that they had enough tag teams to justify that second tag title. I'm not even convinced that the WWF had enough, even at the very kind of height of their massive tag roster. You still only really have about 10 tag teams at any one time. And if there were only 10 wrestlers in the entire promotion, could you justify having several titles for them, or would you just have a world champion, number one contender, and then a bunch of guys that they face?
I mean, that's a pretty good point.
Anyway, this is the Midnight Express versus the Fantastics, and as we come in, several members of the crowd have the letters of Cornette, Cornette. And we get a big Cornette rules chant from these guys. So some heel fans there in Greensboro, which was quite entertaining. And it is interesting that we actually got a shot of it as well. Obviously the Midnight Express are the champions coming into this, and I'm quite looking forward to this match because I really rate Tommy Rogers as a worker, somebody who's not talked about a huge amount, but he's pretty good.
Right.
We get an arm drag from Rogers on Lane to start off with. We get some double teaming from the Fantastics in the Shine sequence. Now, for me, the sound quality had basically gone right down here. It's barely audible.
Same here.
The action goes outside of the ring. Cornette uses a chair. We go back in. Eaton takes a slam from Fulton. Eventually, the Midnights get on top. Rogers is our facing peril. We get a karate kick from Lane. A stiff slap from Eaton. Cornette holds up a table, and then Eaton Irish whips Rogers into it, which was a nice little spot there. We get a brief hope spot from Rogers, who gets a low blow on Lane. But Eaton power slams him, and then he hits an elbow from the top. We get, and I hope I'm calling this right, a side salto suplex from Lane. Is that right?
I believe that's right.
We get some nice double teaming from the Midnights. Five punches in the corner from Eaton, which is a little bit surprising because that's very rare for heels to get that spot. You know, the punches in the turnbuckle. We get a savat kick from Lane, who throws Rogers out. Another table spot. Now, at this point, Cornette does a little jig, which entertained me immensely. I've always said that heels don't dance, but I'd make an exception for Jim Cornette because this was hilarious. He was generally in very excitable mood this evening, Cornette. The fantastic.
Well, yeah, he was an excitable guy for the most part, I would say. You know?
Yeah, but he was especially. I think he'd had an extra cup of coffee this evening. Yeah, this little jig was a highlight of the evening for me. The Fantastics basically need to regroup here because Rogers has taken quite a pounding and he's hurt at this stage. We get a nice elbow drop from Eaton. Cornette nails Rogers with a racket, but then in the finish, Fulton catches him, and he then hits Eaton with a racket. And we have new US tag champs, or do we? Tommy Young comes out, and when Tommy Young, when you see Tommy Young, usually that's a sign that something is going to happen. He consults with Randy, don't call me Pee Wee Anderson. There's general confusion here. And Cornette, basically at this point, Cornette basically goes crazy, takes off his belt, and they have Bobby Fulton, the Midnight Express, basically grab Fulton by his arms and legs. And then Cornette whips Fulton with his belt. And as they leave the ring, he then hits Tommy Young with the tennis racket. Anyway, finally we get a call from Tom Miller, who says that the Midnight Express have won by disqualification, which I think is an absolutely terrible call. Because
yeah.
Clearly, Cornette hit the faces with the racket first. So if Tommy Young's going to interfere, at least get the right call, you know?
Right. Now, the throw over the top, was that the Fantastics being thrown over the top, or was that the Midnight? Who was thrown over the top? I was confused about that.
Oh, it was thrown over the... I actually thought it was because of the use of the tennis racket.
It was an over the top, but I... it was confusing because also the graphics said the Midnight Express won. My thought is that the finish was supposed to be Fantastics win by... win by disqualification, not by pin. But I could be wrong about that.
See, what
either way, it was this type of finish. But yeah, I think the disqualification was from it was an over the top disqualification, and not because of the racket.
Oh right, okay. So I must admit missed that. And you know, without commentary, we have to kind of work these things out for ourselves. So it was kind of a little
sure.
bit difficult. I could barely hear the call being made there.
Okay.
So what do you think of this match?
I liked it. I thought that it was really good, furious start. Like the brawling was pretty intense, and for the most part, the chairs and tables and stuff looked good. There were a couple of weak ones, but you know, given the time that it was, I thought it was pretty strong. Once they kind of got back into the ring, I think there was like a 30-second to minute where like. The Fantastic Four in control, and there was really nothing going on, and it seemed like everyone was trying to figure out what they were doing. But then there was a really good double team move with Eaton doing the jumping clothesline and Lane sweeping the legs, and that kind of once the Midnights got in control at that point, then it got really good again. And you just told me for the first time that I have been mixing up Bobby Fulton and Tommy Rogers for a very long time, because I thought that Fulton was Rogers and Rogers was Fulton, but glancing, you know, and I realized that you are correct and I was wrong. I haven't seen that many Fantastics matches, obviously, so I didn't. I thought that they were the other way for some reason.
Just to be clear, Fulton is the guy with the blonde hair, and Rogers is the guy with the dark hair.
Exactly, and I thought Rogers had the blonde hair, so you were correct. And I thought, yeah, everything built up to the, everything was really well executed once the Midnight took control, Rogers showing good fire, trying to fight against the odds, but the Midnight's doing all the, you know, cheap heel stuff, not really cheap, but all the, you know, good tag team heel stuff, and I liked the look of concern on the fans' faces after Eaton bulldogged Rogers onto the table. That was just like a nice, like, you know, this is 1988 wrestling, and the fans there, whether they believe it's real or not exactly, they're buying into the story that's being told. They're invested in it, so they care about, you know, whether Tommy Rogers is really hurt or not. So I thought, like, in a vacuum, everything was good with the finish, but it being, you know, another dusty finish, another, like, you know, you've screwed us over by the looking like the good guys have won, but, it, you know, being taken back on a cheap technicality, you know, there was obviously a lot of that over the past 2 years, I'm sure, obviously, you've seen. It'd be interesting to see if you guys could count the number of dusty finishes you get from, like, you know, the beginning to at least through, through most of WCW, because it wasn't like it was something they ever stopped doing.
But, I mean, if you go back to the Starrcade 83, 84, 85, I mean, there were so many ref bumps, so many, basically, if Tommy Young is the ref, you know you're not going to get a clean finish.
Right.
I mean, if Tommy Young is in any way involved, something fishy is going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, just to go back to this match a second, Meltzer gave this 4.25 stars. Would you go along with that?
I'm not really a match rating guy, but that seems high. That's it was a good, exciting match, but there was nothing like it wasn't like out of the ordinary good. It was just, you know, a good, fun, entertaining match, but nothing. It's not something that I would demand my friends see or anything like that.
There was an unusual amount of table usage in this match, especially for this time period. And Cornette was kind of more involved than usual, I'd say. Like, he was all over this match. Which was quite entertaining. I thought it was when the Midnights were on top, their offense was all really good. Rogers is good at selling, good at playing that face in peril, and I've always thought he's kind of the Ricky Morton of this team. You know, he carries a lot of their matches if you watch a lot of Fantastics. It was good. Maybe 4.25 is kind of quite high for it, but I'd probably go at least 3.5 if I had. Mm-hmm. If we, you know, we don't usually give ratings, but if I had to, I might go that high with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was good actually to see the Midnight Express in an actual match as opposed to a scaffold match, because I really hate those scaffold matches.
Yeah, I do as well.
So we have a special guest now. Bob Coddle says that we have Eddie Haskell, who is played by Ken Osmond. Now, who is this guy? Any ideas, Jason? What's going on?
Yeah. Here? He is, Leave It to Beaver was a very famous show in the 1950s and was rerun forever on, I mean, it's like one of those iconic television shows. Okay. Are you familiar with it at all? Or?
I don't think this one traveled.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's a very, it would be like one of like the top four or five most famous shows from the 50s. Like, I Love Lucy, you know, that kind of thing. And now it was more of like a, you know, like a, almost like a kid's show or like a family comedy, more like kind of like the 50s equivalent of the Brady Bunch, let's say.
Right, okay. Or like the Cosby Show or something like that.
Well, yeah. Cosby Show was, yeah, had families. Cosby Show was a little bit, like, more intellectual, or, right, you know, in a sense. But yeah, it was kind of, like, it would be, like, Full House or whatever. It was kind of that level of show. And but anyway, the point of having him on was they were having a new Leave It to Beaver on TBS at this point.
Right.
So they're promoting that show.
Okay.
So, which I never watched, but I still remember the rap song that they used in the commercials. And yes, they use a rap song in the commercials to try to promote it. Because in 1988 in the United States, they were using rap songs for every single commercial.
Right. Okay. Was it that kind of like cheesy, kind
yes.
of sub MC Hammer style rap rather
yeah,
than, you know
it
it's
was
not NWA.
Yeah, it was like you know, just the idea of, like, okay, rap is a thing now, so we have to incorporate it, and we'll incorporate it in, like, the most inauthentic, silly way possible to try to, you know, get America to like us.
It's quite interesting. One of the interesting differences, I think, between the US and the UK is that you guys have a lot of TV from the 1950s that continue to be rerun. Whereas when I think of the kind of British sitcoms that have kind of always been shown here, they're more from the 60s and 70s, really. There are very few shows from the 1950s that I can really remember ever being repeated or shown.
Okay.
But I guess that's a US thing in general, that there's a kind of heavy nostalgia for the 1950s, right? I mean, I did...
I mean, maybe it's possible that we just had more shows. I mean, our... You know, just being, of course, Hollywood being in the United States, it may have just been a thing where there are more 50s sitcoms during the time, and some of them, you know, like, were a few years ahead in television in general, or, you know, maybe something like that. I don't know. I know nothing about television in the UK, or know very little about television in the UK, the industry, so I can't say that for sure, but maybe, you know, it was just because there are some shows that were made in the 50s in the United States that kind of held up, where that didn't happen as much until a few years later for you guys.
Yeah, no, I think that's probably right. I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, I think the U.S. in general was back up and on its feet after World War II a lot quicker than
And which would make sense, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, without turning this into a history podcast, I think really that's one of the moments where the U.S. took over as a superpower, a real superpower in history. Yeah. So.
Yeah, we do have Ken Osman. Now, the audio is bad here, but we do have Ken Osman and Jim Cornette sort of. And Jim Cornette is kind of like a Eddie Haskell type character. I mean, Eddie Haskell is a little more innocent, but Eddie Haskell was kind of like the troublemaker of Leave It to Beaver, but he was also kind of like, he would be like, he sort of like aw shucks to the mom on that show. You know, he would kind of be like the rascal, but he would be really nice to the mom. So he would be, you know, the mom would be like, oh, Eddie, you're such a scat. You're such a scamp kind of thing, you know.
Well, I couldn't really make out what was being said, but this looked quite fun, whatever was going on here.
I think Jim Cornette probably would have, like, that would have been fun for him, too, just because he's sort of like the Eddie Haskell of wrestling, and to a certain extent.
Right. So this Eddie Haskell was a reasonably big star then.
Well, I mean, he had been. I mean, this was, again, a revival of the show, and it didn't do anything, but he would have been, like, a name, like, in pop culture, but he did nothing. Like, I don't think Ken Osman, I took a look at his Wikipedia page. It looks like he had been working as a police officer since 1970. So, you know, it wasn't like he wasn't necessarily a big star, but, like, the Eddie Haskell character was a big thing, you know, and was kind of being revived.
Oh wow! Well, I've just clicked on his Wikipedia page here, and his picture is Eddie Haskell. He's like a little kid here. He was like a when the show aired in the 50s, he was like a 14-year-old or something.
Exactly. Yeah, he was a teenager in it. You know, he was the friend of the teenage character, and then the Beaver was a younger. You know, was you know like a 8 or 9 year old kid.
Wow. Well, this is an education for me. I've honestly never heard of this show. So,
okay. That's interesting.
Thanks to Clash of the Champions. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess there are those, because, you know, there are tons of references and stuff like The Simpsons or even in films that go right over our heads. Like, there are probably lots of in-jokes in films that none of us get. But by the same token, there are lots of occasionally when British people will make films, actually Hollywood films, they'll slip in loads of references that I can't imagine anybody getting. And there was a pretty big instance of this during the Olympic ceremony, where both the opening and the closing ceremony of the Olympics were just packed full of stuff that I can't imagine anybody outside the UK would have any idea what, you know. There were just so many references to things that only we would get, you know what I mean? So some things travel, some things don't. But this, maybe I'll ask some of my friends if they've heard of Leave It to Beaver. But it's, I mean, I consider myself someone who's generally up on these sort of things, but obviously this one has passed me by until now. Will you recommend watching it? Is it worth the
watch? No, it's a terrible show. I mean, maybe watch it once just to get the idea about it, but no, it's not good television.
Yeah. There's also was there a Dick Van Dyke show? Was that a long running thing?
Yes, that was the 60s.
That was a 60s thing, okay.
That's a show, that's a great show.
And that was a good show, okay.
A very good show. That's like one of my five favorite television shows of all time, so.
So, we also get an interview here with Gary Hart, who's with Bob Caudle. And he's got with him Al Perez. They want Dusty Rhodes' U.S. title, and Hart says the only way that he can get Perez's shoulders down is with a baseball bat. Now, is Al Perez a baseball player?
No. it's referencing, and they've alluded to it on a few other occasions, it's referencing an angle the night before, or the show before, which would have been a day before this, where basically Magnum TA is out there. He's got a baseball bat. He talks about it being an equalizer. He talks about, like, kind of threats that he's had. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this is, like, more than a year after his accident. Tully Blanchard comes out to confront him and ends up sort of shoving him down. And then Dusty comes in, goes crazy, grabs the baseball bat, and hits Blanchard a bunch of times and starts choking him with it. And then a bunch of wrestlers have to come out, baby faces mostly, and pry Dusty off Tully. And they kind of put over the idea that, like, Dusty was, like, you know, a minute away from killing him. Right. Or at least you're putting him out of wrestling. So, that's going to lead to things in a little bit. If you want to get into that, or if you don't want to get into that, but it leads to sort of an infamous Dusty thing that he would do in 1988.
Okay. Okay. We can get into it.
It leads to the Midnight Rider, I guess. The infamous Midnight Rider. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not.
But. No. I have heard of this. Although Al Perez, I must admit, is not someone who rings any bells with me.
He was sort of like one of those guys who people thought would be like a big deal and then wasn't. I think he was sort of notoriously unreliable, no-showed things. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, he was in World Class for a decent amount of time in the mid-80s. I guess he kind of had like an Austin Idol reputation, where Austin Idol, of course, was known for, well, maybe not of course, but for those who don't know, Austin Idol was a big star in Memphis and Alabama, that kind of thing, and he would often no-show major shows, so eventually stopped being used because of that.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I just pulled up Al Perez here. He actually had a stint in WWF.
I didn't know that.
1989. Well, according to Wikipedia, although we found on this show that Wikipedia is pretty unreliable because they claim that Earl Hebner was in two places at once. Last time out, that he was actually refereeing at Survivor Series '87. But well, he's refereeing on a Starrcade 87 as well.
Okay. Well, maybe to be fair, he has a twin brother, so maybe the twin was doing the refereeing.
Yeah. No. Well, apparently Al Perez wrestled in 1989 against the Brooklyn Brawler, Coco Beware, the Red Rooster, and Bret Hart.
Hmm.
I honestly have never seen Al Perez in the WWF.
I've seen him a couple of times, so.
I've seen him, but I've never seen him in the WF. He's someone who's not really much on my radar, I guess. Whenever he's come up, I didn't really think much to note him, if that makes any sense. So we go from this to Frances Crockett, who is the sister, I think, of David Crockett and Jim Crockett Jr.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right.
And she seems to have the charisma of Jim, not of David, unfortunately. So not much charisma from Frances. And she's here to run down the top 10 teams of the Crockett Cup. So I thought we'd go through these, and maybe I can just get your general thoughts on some of the guys who aren't on the show. We have Ivan Koloff and Dick Murdoch. And one of the ongoing things here that we found is that Ivan Koloff really can't find himself a good tag team partner. So
no.
It's nice to see finally he gets a good partner in Dick Murdoch, because he's had some pretty ropey ones.
Yeah, and I like that they're the mirror image of the superpowers. Because obviously Ivan was Nikita's partner and Dick Murdoch was Dusty's partner.
Oh, I didn't know. Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's a very... some very neat symmetry there.
Yeah.
But of course, I mean, Ivan Koloff, since he was tagging with Nikita, has had some awful partners, including Khrushchev and Vladimir Pietrov.
Yeah.
The next team, just before we move on, any thoughts on Dick Murdoch?
I honestly haven't seen a lot of Dick Murdoch. I mean, from what I've seen, he's great. I know he has that great reputation, but... I've seen maybe 10 or so matches of Dick Murdoch. He's sort of a gap for me.
Right. Yeah. I know Chad is quite high on Dick Murdoch. I'm yet to be convinced that he's deserving of his kind of massive reputation. Because he's one of the guys who talked of as being like a top worker ever. And
sure.
I've never really seen that, to be honest, from him. I've probably seen quite a few Dick Murdoch matches by this stage, and he's never much more than very solid in my book. Then we have Sting and Ron Garvin. We don't see Ron Garvin on this show, so any thoughts on him?
I've always liked Ron Garvin. Even though the NWA title stint isn't well remembered, I love the match where he beats Flair and the rematch where he loses the title. I think those are both terrific matches. I thought he and Flair had a wonderful chemistry and, you know, just really hard hitting, strong matches that were a little bit different than some of the Flair template matches from the time. So I've always enjoyed him. I haven't seen him much outside of that, and of course his 1990 WWF stint, but he's always been one who's enjoyable, even though it's absurdly silly. I do enjoy the Garvin stomp.
Yeah, and I think the best Garvin stomp is from WrestleMania 5 or no, WrestleMania 6, I think it is, on Frenchy Martin.
Yes,
when he actually sells it with the shaking leg. Okay, then we have the Varsity Club. I think that's basically Kevin Sullivan and Rick Steiner, right?
Rotundo. Oh, I guess I was assuming it was Rotundo and Steiner, but I guess Rotundo is a singles guy, so I guess it'd be Sullivan and Steiner. I had thought about that.
I think it would be those two. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Then we have the Fantastics, Wyndham and Luger, the Powers of Pain, Midnight Express, the Road Warriors, Dusty Rhodes and Nikita Koloff. And the number one ranked team is, of course, the world champs, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little bit of hype for the Crockett Cup there. And, I mean, when you look at that as a roster, I know not all of these were full-time tag teams, but most of them were. That's a pretty decent... that's 10 pretty decent teams there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Jason.
All right, thank you.
Fans, for all of us here at WCW Center Stage, for Cowboy Bill Watts and the American Dream Dusty Rhodes, I'm Jim Ross saying good night, everybody.